Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is a simple blood test that is analyzing little itsy-bitsy fragments of DNA.
The test is simple, but can we handle the complicated results? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Right now we're holding for 30 seconds, okay?
Guilt or shame down the price.
It's not your ear.
But that doesn't mean that we should just continue on the same course.
The price must be driven down.
People with tone deafness hear just fine.
They send him to the women's bathroom to see an internal medicine doctor.
Well, I'll just wait outside, so.
I'm going to give you the red light. When you see the red light,
one of the things that tends to happen with the rankings.
I don't have a pulse.
I'm trying to solve the problems that we had 100,000 to 100,000 years ago.
I think most of us get it.
That's what I found, like, on the inside.
On today's show, eliminating deadly mosquitoes by breeding more mosquitoes, keeping chickens safe by killing chickens, and digging deep into the secret of consciousness. But first up, the sheer number of genetic tests has exploded in the past decade or so, changing people's lives and the field of medicine. We're going to dig into these changes, starting with a look at pregnancy, one human experience that has forever been altered by genetic testing.
It's made it more complicated. It's made it more technologic. But I think that it's settled into a place where it is empowering the pregnant woman by giving her information and knowledge.
Veteran OBGYN Stuart Wiener of Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia with a knowledge is power take on prenatal testing. But with the option of tests also comes a lot of worrying, uncertainty, and tough choices. The majority of women receive some form of screening for problems or genetic testing during the first trimester, often soon after a first ultrasound confirms the pregnancy.
I went to my first prenatal appointment with the OBGYN this morning. Everything was fine. They actually saw a heartbeat at 6 weeks, which they didn't know if they were going to be able to, so that was really exciting.
You can hear the apprehension in this voice. The woman, she didn't want me to use her name because nobody other than her husband knows she's pregnant yet. And that apprehension is about everything that could go wrong that she could yet find out.
My inclination now, as far as genetic testing, is I kind of want to do whatever is available to me. I am very much a need-to-knower, so the idea of having any less uncertainty is really preferable to me.
What expectant parents, especially those over the age of 35, seem most concerned about and want to test for is Down syndrome, the most common genetic disorder in the United States. About 1 in 700 babies are born with it.
Prior to prenatal testing, Down syndrome was a surprise postnatal diagnosis.
Brian Scottko co-directs the Down syndrome program at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
But Down syndrome now is really shifting from a postnatal diagnosis to a prenatal one.
French physician Jérôme Lejeune identified Down syndrome as a chromosomal condition in 1959, where chromosome 21 is triplicated rather than duplicated. Invasive tests such as amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling have been available since the 70s, but 5 years ago, prenatal testing took a massive leap forward.
Pregnancy, as we know it, changed in October of 2011 here in the United States, and that's when the cell-free DNA non-invasive prenatal screening test was introduced.
This is a simple blood test for the expectant woman. It analyzes tiny fragments of DNA from the placenta in the mother's blood, and it can detect if there is an extra copy of chromosome 21. These tests can be done as early as 9 weeks into the pregnancy, and they are highly accurate. If a woman gets a positive result, she is encouraged to still complete a more invasive test before making any further decisions.
Each year in the United States, only about 2% of expectant women pursue amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling, which are the only two tests that can confirm Down syndrome diagnostically.
And if that test comes back positive, Scottko says many couples feel like they've been punched in the stomach. The vision of the future is suddenly changed. A serious illness is now in the picture, a child who will likely need care and support their entire lives. It often becomes an overwhelming question of emotional and financial resources. And in this pressure cooker of uncertainties,
research shows about 74% will choose to terminate their pregnancy.
In real numbers, says Scottko, that translates to about 3,100 Down syndrome-related abortions each year. About 5,300 babies with Down syndrome are born annually. Many women decide to forego further testing, and many still find out after birth. Scottko just completed a massive study of these numbers, and he expects that the effect of prenatal screening on this population will only increase as tests become available earlier on in the pregnancy. Despite the many potentially scary, high-tech aspects of pregnancy, for many expecting parents, this is still a time of true joy.
We were so excited, you know, and I think we even told our parents on Mother's Day. We had them here, and we made a big champagne punch and made the announcement.
It was wonderful.
Yes. Candace and Tim Oglein live in Marlton, New Jersey. She's a nurse. He's a graphic designer. They had suffered a miscarriage early in their marriage, and they were thrilled to be expecting again. They made plans and talked names.
If it was a girl, she would name her.
Victoria.
And if he's a boy, I would name him. And I wanted to have a name that would look good on a book jacket for when he was going to be a famous writer someday.
Candace was 40 at the time, her physician suggested some genetic testing. The test showed an elevated risk for Down syndrome, and the genetic counselor said she could consider an amniocentesis. Candace declined.
If we did come with those results and it was positive, we weren't going to do anything anyway.
When their son Philip was born, they were told he had features of Down syndrome and needed to undergo genetic testing. Candace didn't believe it at first. In the hours and days after his birth, she told herself Philip was squinting or that his face was swollen from birth. Then she looked at Philip's newborn pictures taken at the hospital.
And when I saw the picture, I can see the Down syndrome features in the picture. And I just start crying. And I'm crying, and I'm all upset.
3 days later, her doctor called her up with the definite diagnosis. Philip had Down syndrome.
I just couldn't even talk. And he's like, Candy, are you okay? Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'm not okay. No, I'm not okay.
The Ogleins went to see their priest to talk about the grief they felt over the loss of the child they thought they would have. The priest asked them to rethink what happiness meant to them. Could they be happy if Philip was happy? Both say it was a simple question that helped them find a new outlook. Philip is 5 years old now.
He's an amazing little boy. We just can't imagine him being different or not having him around. I mean, he's just a wonderful little kid, and we just love him.
Like pretty much every kid his age, he loves his parents' smartphones, and he knows how to take pictures.
Mommy.
Yes.
Cheese.
Tim.
Cheese. Did he say Tim? Yes. Yeah. Instead of calling him Daddy, he calls him Tim. Speech-wise, he is delayed. Even though Philip is 5 years old, developmentally he's 2.5. I think he is wonderful. And he's ours.
Brian Scottko has published research on how Down syndrome affects the people who live with the disorder.
And 99% of people with Down syndrome said they're happy with their lives, and 99% said they like how they look. You know, when you interview the typical Americans, only about 45% of us are happy with our lives.
Scottko says a lot of the health problems that tend to accompany Down syndrome, in addition to intellectual disability, such as heart or thyroid disease, can be fixed today. And the 200,000 people with a disorder in the U.S. today are living longer lives.
And since people with Down syndrome are living longer, we don't know what impact that will have on the competing number of increasing terminations.
Several states, including Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Ohio, have enacted Down syndrome information legislation where parents must get additional information on what it means to live with the condition when they receive a prenatal diagnosis. Scottko feels that Down syndrome is the canary in the coal mine, a peek at how humans will respond and cope as more and more genetic conditions can be tested for. Jefferson OBGYN Stuart Weiner shares this concern.
It's quite clear that in the not-too-distant future, we'll have the ability to do a complete genome sequence on the unborn fetus with just a blood test from the mother. That's going to create, has already created, a lot of fascinating ethical discussions because you're finding out more than we know what to do with.
We're finding out more than we know what to do with. It feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? We wanted to talk to NYU medical ethicist Art Kaplan about everything we've just heard, and we reached him on vacation. He's in Aruba. Art, do you agree more information than we can handle, not just in terms of prenatal testing, but with genetic testing in general?
I do agree. It does seem to me that we're almost getting a fire hose of information pointed at us, and we have a very hard time figuring out, well, what does it all mean? A lot of it is about risk factors, not about diseases, but a lot of the risk factors are things that we can't do much about. We inherit them, but it's not like we can change our lifestyle or our diet or something. And on the other hand, there's not even agreement about what constitutes something we should be concerned about. A simple example is albinism. When people are born with white skin in America, they don't tend to worry about it. But in most parts of the world, it's stigmatized and considered horrible. Would you end a pregnancy because your child looks like they're at risk of being deaf, when there are a lot of deaf people that say that's not an issue? Or short stature? Or many, many other genetic conditions that Asperger's, autism, that might have genetic links but could also produce a child with a happy life. So plenty of room to argue about, well, what is a disease or what's something that should concern us?
Now, risks and risk factors are especially hard to interpret for lay people, and sometimes that seems to be a problem with these tests.
Well, I think trying to go with these tests without having counseling available is really, really not a good idea. I think we're all bad at statistics. We're all bad at trying to compute the relative risks that we face. You know, if somebody says to me, you're at triple risk of a very rare disease, that may mean I'm moving from 1 in a million to 3 in a million. And I could worry about that and say, my goodness, I have a highly increased risk of getting a very rare, unusual disease, but that would distort me from paying attention to the need to lose weight or the need to exercise or the need to wear a helmet when I go out on my bicycle. So you need someone, I think, to at least give you the option of some counseling. Just going at the numbers yourself, I think, is not going to work out well.
Art, who will get to decide ultimately, with more choices, how far we take this thing?
You know, I think at the end of the day, the United States is not a country that relies on government regulation when it comes to reproduction. It makes politicians crazy. It makes them nervous. It gets them into the abortion debate. We start arguing about what is an embryo, when does life begin. And most politicians, if they can, run away. So I'm going to give you a grim prediction. I think the marketplace is going to sort it out. I think what we're going to see is businesses advertising, build a better baby, build a healthier baby. Some will do it based on fear-mongering. Some will do it responsibly. But I worry that the future of what gets tested, who gets tested, what they get told, why they get tested, is going to be a matter of commerce, not health.
So how do you see your role as a medical ethicist? What do you guys have to do here?
I think it's very important that the medical ethics community, the bioethicists, start talking about this now, as we're doing. Start asking doctors and medical societies to set rules. If the government won't do it, there's no reason that doctors and genetic counselors and others can say, we will do this, we won't do that, that's not a disease, we don't test for that. We're not in the business of eugenics, we're in the business of getting rid of diseases and severe disorders. That's where our priorities have to be. So I think we should be working with patient advocates, with disease organizations, and with the medical profession to sort of say, well, here are the guidelines. If no one else will come up with them, then let's do it that way.
Art, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Art Kaplan heads the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University, and he spoke to us from Aruba. Art talked about the importance of explaining testing results to patients. That's what genetic counselors do, but their field is struggling to keep up with demand. Todd Bookman reports.
The first time Erica Stalling's mom had breast cancer, this was in the early 1990s, doctors didn't yet fully understand the role her genes may have played in the disease. But then 14 years later, in 2007, her mom's cancer comes back.
And that's when the doctors sort of realized that there may be something genetic going on. And that's when she was tested and she found out that she was a carrier for BRCA2.
BRCA1 and 2 are genes. They're found on our 17th chromosome. Sometimes you'll hear them called BRCA1 or 2. When you have a mutated BRCA gene, it puts you at a higher risk for breast cancer. Because Erica's mom is positive, that means there's a 50-50 chance she would have inherited a mutated BRCA2 gene. But remember, she's a senior in college at this time, 22 years old. Getting tested just wasn't a priority.
So, you know, at the time, I had just gotten accepted into law school. I was going to be moving to D.C. I knew, like, my ultimate goal was to, like, get a job and, like, move to Manhattan. So I don't want to say I pushed it to the back of my mind, but I sort of, you know, it didn't seem super pressing at the time.
Fast forward a few years, Stalling's law career and her New York life are settled. She's got a supportive boyfriend. She felt like she was finally in a good place to get the test. Nervous, but ready to deal with the potential results. So she calls to make an appointment and is told that she first needs to meet with a genetic counselor to start the process. But the wait to get in to see a counselor, it turns out, is 5 months long. After working up the guts to finally make the call, this wait was not welcome news.
You know, it just sort of adds like a level of stress to something that's already stressful.
Stalling's is not alone in feeling that frustration. There are just 4,000 genetic counselors in the country today. That's one for every 80,000 Americans. It's not enough to keep up with the surge in demand.
As genetic testing is growing and becoming more widely adopted by everyone for all sorts of different things, not just pregnancy, but, you know, cancer, heart disease, there is a disconnect. Who will actually interpret and provide those results to patients?
This is Neha Kumar, who directs a team of about 20 genetic counselors at a company called Recombine. Recombine offers a screening test for parents to see what genetic diseases they may pass on to a child. Serious things like cystic fibrosis and Tay-Sachs disease. They offer both pre- and post-test genetic counseling to people, going over what the tests are, what they may reveal, and what the gray areas might mean. The counseling session can last 30 minutes, sometimes an hour. It's the type of thorough conversation other medical providers just don't have the bandwidth for.
It's not necessarily about skill, it's about time.
Plus, with thousands of new tests developed in recent years, genetic counselors have a unique understanding of what the right screenings may be given the patient's family history. Until recently, the industry was keeping up with the increased demand. But then in 2013, there were some major shakeups.
The first was the Supreme Court decision that patenting of genes was no longer an option.
This is Joy Larson-Hidley with the National Society of Genetic Counselors. She's talking about the Supreme Court's ruling that a testing company called Myriad Genetics couldn't claim ownership of BRCA1 and 2. Almost immediately, other, much cheaper tests for these mutations came to the market. And that same year, 2013, there was this.
Angelina Jolie made a surprise announcement this morning. The Oscar winner is revealing.
Angelina Jolie says with a history of cancer in her family and an inherited gene.
She is the epitome of Hollywood glamour and beauty.
Angelina Jolie stunned the world with the recent announcement.
Announcing she had both breasts removed and signaling.
Her sharing that information was really important because it allowed people to identify with her story. If it could happen to Angelina Jolie, it could happen to me.
Hidley says it started a culture shift. People became much more willing to talk about their genetic predispositions and their options. Demand for testing has remained high since Angelina Jolie's disclosure. But Hidley points out that for lots of patients, especially those not getting breast cancer screenings, the wait time to see a counselor is often just a week or two. Still, it's not that easy to just crank out more certified counselors. These are highly trained people. They go through a 2-year master's program and get extensive hands-on training. Right now, there are only about 30 universities offering degree programs, something leaders in the field hope to expand. 300 or so new counselors will graduate this spring, including Nori Williams, who is finishing up at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, the country's oldest and largest program in human genetics. She comes off as part science buff, part therapist.
From a young age, I was always intrigued by how our genetic makeup, this like intrinsic code that's so mysterious and still not well understood, sort of impacts who we are, myself and all the people around me. And then when I found out about genetic counseling specifically, it combined my intellectual curiosities with my more empathetic qualities.
Wow, you've thought about that?
Yes, daily.
Because of the shortage of trained counselors, Williams is already getting job offers. Basically, everyone does.
As like the technology and understanding of genetics grows, the insight that genetic counselors can provide is also growing exponentially. So the job market looks great, and I'm very excited.
The average starting salary for a counselor is about $65,000 to $75,000. Many insurers, including Medicare, typically don't cover counseling sessions, meaning hospitals frequently eat the costs. But they keep hiring counselors because of their clear value to patients. One insurer is taking the opposite approach, though. After the spike that's been dubbed the Angelina Jolie effect, Cigna began mandating that anyone interested in getting a BRCA test had to first meet with a counselor, even if a doctor already approved the screening. That didn't sit well with some doctors' groups, who saw the move as a barrier to care. Not surprisingly, counselors like Stephanie Winheld at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital liked the move.
I don't see that as a barrier. I think that it's really important for patients to get upfront counseling so that they sort of know what they're getting themselves into.
Case in point, Winheld says, are the at-home genetic testing products like 23andMe, where you give them a little spit and they give you your risks for Bloom syndrome and hearing loss. Winheld says patients who try to research genetic test results on their own don't always interpret what they read correctly.
With Googling things, you either see the very, very bad or the very, very good, and you don't really see that middle.
For Erica Stallings, the New York lawyer, her genetic counseling experience was helpful once she finally got in to see someone. Like her mother, she tested positive for the BRCA2 mutation. Her counselor spent time going through her options and connected her with outside therapists, surgeons, and other supports.
I just always tell people, like, it's not just enough to know that you're positive. Like, you have to see someone who can, like, put those results in, like, context for you.
With the backing of her counselor, Stallings decided to have a preventive double mastectomy last December at the age of 29. She's now volunteering with a breast cancer awareness group, helping to share her genetic story with more women. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We heard a lot of talk about mosquitoes this week, which is kind of strange during the winter, but this story plays out mostly in Brazil, where it's summer right now, and some doctors are advising women not to get pregnant. This may be an extreme stance, but last week, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control issued a travel alert for pregnant women to consider avoiding about a dozen countries in South America and the Caribbean. It's all due to a growing outbreak of a mosquito-borne virus called Zika. Scientists think the virus has caused major birth defects in Brazil. This has health leaders looking to all sorts of weapons, including genetically engineered mosquitoes. Alana Gordon has more.
Under almost any other circumstances, Sara Mota should be really excited right now. But she's not.
Everybody becomes so sad and so worried.
Mota is 12 weeks pregnant. And talking with her through Skype in her third-floor apartment in Salvador, Brazil, I can see that she's visibly upset. Zika is on her mind. It's a mosquito-borne virus that doctors in Brazil think is causing a sharp rise in brain deformities in the newborns of infected moms. Mota, who's 36, didn't know about this risk when she got pregnant. Now she's doing everything she can to avoid being bit. That's not an easy feat in Brazil.
It's so sad because I have to wash all the time. I sleep with pants and a big sheet.
Mota shows me a recent selfie of her Zika outfit. She's completely covered with a blue long-sleeve shirt, shiny white spandex pants, and thick white socks. This is not a typical outfit for 95-degree South American summers.
It's so hot here, you know? It's very, very hot.
In the last few years, Zika has gone from a really obscure virus in Asia and Africa to one that's now present in 14 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. Dr. Anthony Fauci directs the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He says the battle against Zika is being fought on several fronts. But Zika's tricky.
The trouble with Zika is that it is so similar to other flaviviruses such as dengue that in a population such as Brazil, in which dengue is widespread, you have cross-reactivity of the test between Zika and dengue, so you really can't tell whether the person had been previously infected with dengue or whether they actually have Zika.
Fauci says researchers are working to address that. One advantage is vaccine efforts are already well underway for those other viruses.
So we have a head start on that.
But even under the best of circumstances, it would take a couple years for a safe and effective vaccine to get in the hands of someone like Sara Mota. So another approach that's gaining traction in Brazil is targeting the mosquitoes themselves. The army has been called in some areas. And then there's this.
Okay.
This is a video of people from the UK company Oxitec opening a white crate in the middle of a muddy street in northeastern Brazil last year.
They're
releasing specially bred mosquitoes as part of a trial with the local government. Hayden Perry is Oxitec's CEO.
Well, I'd describe our mosquito the same way as the press do, actually, in Brazil, which is the friendly mosquito.
Perry says the mosquitoes being released are all males, so they don't bite. But they are anything but friendly to their wild, disease-carrying buddies.
So we just release the males. The males go out, they mate with females, and those females, their offspring die.
That's because these are genetically modified mosquitoes, also known as transgenic mosquitoes. They contain a fatal self-exterminating gene that can be passed on to other disease-carrying mosquitoes in the wild. Researchers at Oxford came up with the approach, and it involves injecting mosquitoes with an agent that alters their DNA. They then breed them, and then the idea is if enough of them are released at the right place and the right time, they can help wipe out the threat in those targeted areas.
Well, it's the same sort of science that you would use for producing a genetically modified crop.
But much like GMOs in our food supply, the concept has faced some pushback on U.S. soil. A few years ago, a proposal to use Oxitec's mosquitoes was rejected in an area of Florida that had experienced several cases of dengue fever. People worried about unintended consequences of messing with nature. Perry likes to think of it as a safer alternative to insecticides. Several small trials of Oxitec's transgenic mosquitoes have taken place around the world in recent years, and the company's in the final approval stages of commercializing the product in Brazil. But even Perry acknowledges it's no magic bullet.
The battle against mosquitoes is a very continual one. We're not changing that. What we're just doing is saying, look, actually, if you add our tool to the tools that are already there, then actually we've got a chance of winning.
Other scientists are in the early stages of developing transgenic mosquitoes that are unable to carry viruses like malaria. Back in Salvador, Brazil, Sara Mota welcomes the new approaches, but she knows it won't come soon enough for her. So for now, she clutches one of her biggest weapons. It's a bottle of Exposis, an insect repellent so popular, she says, that the pharmacies have sold out of it.
I put every 2 hours, I put again. It's so strong, so strong.
So strong, she hopes, that it can stave off mosquitoes until her baby is in the clear. Mota is due in early August. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon. Tem que tá bonito, tem que dar cor ao espírito, tem que saravar e dizer poemas.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're going to move on to another big story that's dominated the news all week, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Here's a quick basic timeline. In April of 2014, the city stopped using Detroit water from Lake Huron and started drawing its drinking water from the Flint River instead. This was a move to cut costs. The Flint River water is corrosive. It was not treated correctly, and as a result, lead leached from old pipes and fixtures into the drinking water. The city switched back to Detroit water in October of last year, but the damage to the system has been done and the drinking water is still not safe. $5 million in federal aid will go to Flint to help resolve the crisis. Safe drinking water is a major problem for many communities around the country, and we're joined now by Charles Fishman. He's written The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Charles, what are some of the lessons that communities could take away from what's happened in Flint?
I think the most important lesson we can learn from Flint is that tap water is something that is hidden. It's taken for granted, but it's absolutely indispensable to the economy of communities and to people's sense of well-being and also the reality of their well-being. What's going on in Flint is that for literally months, the water system has poisoned the residents of an American city with lead, and that's directly undermined the health of the people in that community, but it's also destroyed, for instance, the property values of their homes. Nobody can sell a house in Flint because no one wants to buy a house in a city where the house is connected to a tap water system that doesn't work. And so our tap water systems are brilliant. They are typically brilliantly engineered. We depend on them every minute of every day, and yet we don't pay any attention to them, and many of them are in the kind of condition that got Flint into trouble.
What are the challenges in maintaining these systems in cities all over the U.S.?
Well, look, we rely on the engineering enterprise and the forward thinking of city and community officials from 100 years ago or more. The water systems in big cities are old. That doesn't mean they're bad. It just means they're buried and we haven't paid that much attention to them. In Philadelphia, for instance, I did a little checking. The average age of the water pipes in Philadelphia is 78 years. That means the typical water supply pipe in Philadelphia was installed in 1937. Now, we aren't using phones from 1937 or radios from 1937. In most cases, we aren't using electrical systems from 1937. But every day, people in Philadelphia are using water that comes through pipes from 1937.
But paying for these hidden infrastructures is not sexy. And people might say, well, we want libraries, we want good schools. I don't care about these pipes. So it's a hard case to make.
Well, let's be honest. When you drive around America's cities, even the things that are visible, the bridges, the libraries, the schools, it's often hard to muster funding for those. But here's the interesting thing about water. Now, this is not true in Flint, where the water bills have gone through the roof in part because of Flint's financial troubles. But around the country, the typical American family of four pays just $34 a month for clean, fresh tap water delivered to their home in essentially unlimited quantities, a buck a day. And so we can afford to increase our water bills just a little bit. Even 10%, that comes to $3 a month, a dime, and devote all of that money to upgrading the water system. In this country, we spend $26 billion a year on bottled water and $46 billion on the entire water system in the country. So that's kind of ridiculous. We could spend just a little bit less on the bottled water and a little more on the water system.
Charles, you traveled a lot when you wrote your book. Did you see any communities that are doing water right?
One of my favorite cities is a little below the radar screen is San Antonio. In San Antonio, the voters themselves passed a 1 penny on $8 sales tax. You have to spend $8 to incur a one penny tax to buy land to protect the watershed and the aquifer around San Antonio. And that little fund generates $40 or $50 million a year. And taxpayers understand very clearly that that tiny little sales tax is protecting the city's water supply for centuries to come. In San Antonio, they will buy you a water-saving toilet and install it in your home or your office if you have old-fashioned toilets, because the city council in San Antonio understands that the cost of finding water for outdated toilets is much more expensive than giving people new toilets. There are lots of places in the country that are tackling water problems. The most important thing is there is no one solution, and you can't sort of go in, work real hard for 9 months, fix your water system, and never have to think about it again.
Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mikan.
Charles Fishman is a writer, a reporter, and he has written The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mikan Scott. There's an outbreak of bird flu going on in Indiana right now. The strains aren't a real danger to people, but this is still a very big issue. There was an outbreak in the United States in June of last year. Nearly 50 million turkeys and laying hens had to be killed back then, and the price for a dozen eggs doubled in some places. The economic cost to poultry producers was enormous, so that has put farmers across the country on high alert. Tanya English went to see the precautions East Coast farmers are taking to avoid an outbreak.
It was migrating wild birds that first brought a particularly deadly avian influenza called H5 to the United States. Protecting poultry starts with monitoring those wild birds. They settle down on wetlands, defecate, drool, and generally spread their germs around. Waterfowl that feed on the surface of ponds carry bird flu, but often don't show any symptoms.
When we're looking for the needle in the haystack, the high pathogenic avian influenza virus, we want to look in the right haystack, and dabbling ducks is the group of birds we're targeting.
That's wildlife biologist Larry Hinman. He's part of a federal effort to test thousands of birds. Hinman works for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and he's also a hunter.
I'm Tanya English.
Pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for doing this. How did it go this morning?
Slow, cold and slow.
Yeah.
The government is gathering DNA samples from dead birds bagged by hunters like Hinman.
What's exciting is seeing them is fooling them, getting them within gun range, you know, either by using your calls and the decoys and the weather conditions to your advantage. Duck hunters will tell you it's a magic moment. That's what most of us appreciate the most. But when you see ducks, you want to give them what they call a high ball or come look at me type call. Everything's cool over here. There's food over here.
The morning we met, Hinman downed a dabbling duck called a green-winged teal. Then he spent the rest of the day working. We drove around the eastern shore, meeting up with other hunters and their dogs, hoping to find black ducks or mallards to test.
Randy.
Hey, how you doing?
Have any luck?
I don't have any ducks for you.
Dang.
Not a damn duck. I wish I did. I got three empty shells.
Biologists plan to test the ducks through the end of the winter migration.
We record the vial number, the date that we sample, the location.
But so far, there are no signs of the bird flu that kills domestic birds. Still, agricultural experts have stepped up biosecurity, just in case. Every producer is supposed to have a plan to keep infectious disease off the farm, and those plans are part of a national system. One of the security checkpoints along the way is at Penn State University's Animal Diagnostic Lab.
Well, what we need to do first is be able to get on some protective clothing, because we don't know where you've come, and we don't know where you're going to go after this.
Professor Mike Hewlett wants to show me the birds his team is raising. But you can't get into any chicken house these days without first disinfecting your boots and putting on blue paper pajamas.
So I just put these on over my boots and up over the bottom of my pants.
And then a hairnet. And then we also have some gloves.
They call this booted and suited, is that right?
That's right. We're ready to go out and look at some birds.
The agricultural school grows demonstration and research hens, roosters, and the broiler chickens that end up on the dinner table.
Trying to make a good product and help feed the world.
Before companies send their meat birds to market, they send saliva and blood samples to Penn State for testing. Ruffled feathers or odd-shaped eggs often mean a bird is sick. But the H5 bird flu is so fast-acting and contagious, farmers can often miss those signs.
So one of the biggest symptoms that they had was mortality.
And they're dead. That's the first thing you notice.
That's the first thing that they found out in Minnesota and Iowa.
Reaching down, Hewlett grabs a bird and holds on while he swirls a cotton swab in its air pipe. It's kind of like when you go to the doctor for a throat culture to see if you have strep throat. Penn State checks the sample to see if there's live active virus in the bird right now. Hewlett also needs some blood, so he sticks a vein under one wing and the chicken complains a bit. Different from the throat swab, the blood test detects antibodies left behind as disease works its way through the body. And that gives veterinarians a snapshot of illness circulating in an animal 5 or 10 days ago.
Really what happens, a chicken becomes a virus factory. I'm Bill Brown, I'm the poultry extension agent with the University of Delaware.
With his beard, his ball cap, and his sturdy body, this guy is literally Farmer Brown. He grows his own chickens and teaches new agricultural practices to family farmers. He also reminds them about biosecurity. Unless you have real business on the farm, farmers prefer that you kindly keep out.
Absolutely no visitors. You all are an exception because we feel like the risk or the advantage of educating the public is worth having you here today.
Brown works on Delmarva, a peninsula made up from portions of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. It's a tiny place, but the poultry industry is huge. Brown says it only takes one mistake and a bit of infected chicken poop on your shoe to move bird flu from one farm to the next. The chickens leave virus behind in the dust and dander, and it gets on farm equipment and people.
I'm Charles Postles.
What do you do?
I'm a farmer, raise poultry in Milford and Delaware.
Postles and other family farmers contract with big companies like Tyson Foods and Purdue. He has 90,000 birds just about ready to go to market. There's a lot at stake, and he's not letting me anywhere near his chickens.
I mean, you see how many chicken houses you've seen going up and down the road. It's a very much more concentrated industry, and so we're prepared, trying to be as prepared as we can.
There's no vaccine and no medicine to cure high-path avian flu. If biosecurity doesn't work, depopulation is the primary way to stop the disease. That's what happened last year when 48 million birds had to be killed in the Midwest. Postal says the industry across Delmarva is ready to respond quickly. If there's an outbreak, there are 4 machines on standby just for this region.
It just makes a foam layer about 3 feet deep and it euthanizes the chickens. It's very quick, and then the birds are composted within the house. Then they cook. I mean, that composting raises the temperature to usually over 140 degrees.
That kills the pathogens, and after that, the farm operation has to sit empty for weeks. That's big money on the line. The industry on the East Coast has had some luck, and farmers aren't taking any chances.
We're not out of the woods probably until March. A lot of opportunity for this thing to explode yet this year.
Tanya English reported the story. You're listening to The Pulse, and we've talked about a lot of tough issues on today's show. Are you ready for one more? This one relates to how our minds work, and it has actually been labeled the hard problem by a philosopher. Okay, in contrast, here's a relatively easy problem, understanding how the brain reacts to pain. If you stub your toe, neuroscientists know how your nerves send signals to a certain portion of your brain, which lights up. That's pain. And while pain is bad, we understand it. I'll leave it to Peter Crimmins to explain the hard problem.
The hard problem is consciousness. How are we able to be aware of ourselves such that we develop personalities, identities, thoughts and feelings? What does it feel like for you to be you? David Chalmers is a philosopher of consciousness, and he says the traditional scientific method of studying the brain cannot account for subjectivity.
We understand things in terms of mechanisms. The brain, and it's a giant mechanism, and that's great for explaining some things, behavior and response. But in consciousness, we have this added element of subjectivity at the very core, what it feels like from the inside. And that's just not a matter of explaining some objective mechanism.
In the last couple decades, scientists have been using more concrete methods to study consciousness. These are physicists and neuroscientists who rely on measurable evidence and repeatable methods. And as it turns out, stubbing your toe is a pretty good barometer of consciousness. If you've ever told your doctor where you are on the pain scale, say you're a 4 out of 10 or you're an 8, you essentially revealed your state of consciousness.
Pain is a part of consciousness. You know, consciousness for me is anything which feels a certain way from the inside. Pain is a subjective experience. It's one of the paradigm ones. So is vision. So is, like, you know, just seeing a red triangle or a blue sky.
There is no measurement to determine if the way you experience the color red is the same way I do. That's the kind of subjectivity Chalmers was thinking about in the 1990s when he coined the phrase the hard problem. But this problem of consciousness has been with philosophy since the toga. Over time, as a way to talk about it, philosophers had to invent anti-consciousness, a hypothetical being that has no sense of self, essentially a zombie. Chalmers even wrote a song about zombies, which he will only sing at philosophy conferences.
It would take a number of drinks to be willing to sing it.
Fortunately, YouTube exists.
I act like you act. I do what you do. But I don't know what it's like to be you.
Although a zombie appears to act like a normal person, it has no internalized concept of itself, so it can't ascribe meaning or value to anything it experiences.
I got the zombie blues.
There is another, more sober way to talk about consciousness. Playwright Tom Stoppard is perhaps most well-known for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, a play turned into a movie in 1990. His newest play is called The Hard Problem.
My interest, I think, actually came from a slightly different angle. I think that the idea of morality, the idea of the difference between good and bad, is unintelligible without consciousness.
Don't you believe in good, Spike?
The play, now running at the Wilma Theater in Philadelphia, involves a young woman applying for a coveted job at an academic institute studying the brain.
It takes millions of years to evolve.
Her advisor, and sometimes lover, tries to convince her that all of human behavior is based on evolutionary biology. Even altruism is just survival of the fittest in disguise.
Altruism is always self-interest. Just needs a little working out.
Like you, going miles out of your way to give me a lift home.
Exactly. It's a cost-benefit thing. Oh, I go miles out of my way because you might invite me in for coffee. I throw in a tutorial to get into your...
pants.
Good graces, I was going to say, but you're basically right on the biology.
The woman insists that morality is innately valuable to humans, yes, regardless of the survival instinct, but she can't prove it.
Human life is somehow pointless without having a sense of value in things which can't be quantified. I'm talking about things having a sublime or metaphysical value that seems to be central to any kind of society, actually central to any human individual.
Now, Stoppard did not set out to write a philosophical treatise. He's in the business of writing plays that are entertaining. Nevertheless, he is in the long philosophical tradition of writing fictional dialogues to work out thorny problems from multiple angles. Chalmers says it points out how much we still don't know about the human brain. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
The
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Libby Tracy is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, our associate producer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.